This is the Atari 8-bit podcast.
In this episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast, Kevin plays with an Atari gadget that he pre-ordered 3 years ago and forgot about. Randy tells everything you wanted to know about connecting your PC to your Atari, and poor Brad ends up with more Texas Instruments 99 4A computers than he knows what to do with. Also, we've got an interview with the president of one of the oldest Atari user groups. Let's go! Hello there, welcome to another adrenaline-packed episode of Antic, the Atari podcast. The purpose of this here's the purpose of this podcast. We love Atari computers. They're fun, and we want you to love them too. Let's just get started, shall we? This is episode 5. I'm Kevin Savitz. I'm your host for this episode. I'm joined by my co-host, Randy Kindig, who is the host of the Floppy Days podcast, coming to us from sunny Indianapolis, and Brad Arnold, president of the Atlanta Historical Computer Society and former Navy bubblehead. So, Randy, what you been up to?
Well, hey, how are you guys?
Fantastic.
I've been pretty good. I feel like I've had a lot going on as far as Atari things, so I'll try not to talk too long here, but I have had a lot of things going on. First of all, I attended Vintage Computer Festival Midwest in Chicago, which was a lot of fun in the end of September. I had a table with a display with where I had some information about Antic and Floppy Days podcasts. And overall, the show was pretty well attended. There were probably, and they don't keep count really, but there were probably somewhere at least 100 people there, I would guess. But since admission is free, we don't really know exactly. There were three big rooms in a hotel basement where they hold the conference. And there were a lot of displays and vendors, as well as a lot of presentations, most of which were Commodore-related, unfortunately, as the show is put on jointly by the local Commodore Club. But in any event, from an Atari perspective, it was very well represented. There were a couple of large tables with Atari equipment displayed, and some of the vendors around the other rooms had Atari equipment displayed as well. I was able to get a few interviews, including one with Nick DeMasi, president of the local Atari group, which will be presented later in this episode. For more details about the show, you can listen to episode 7 of the Floppy Days podcast. The main topic of that show was Vintage Computer Festival Midwest. So if you ever get the chance, I would highly recommend that you attend.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
It was. It was a great time. Also, during the last show, I mentioned that rather than acquiring any more computers or other computer equipment at this time, because my space is pretty much maxed out, I would work on getting upgrades for my existing computers. So for the Atari 8-bit line, I have had the chance to order a couple of devices, a SD interface from Lotharec, as well as an SIDE2, which is a compact flash interface from the same person. Mm-hmm. And I'm excited to get and start working with these items. And I smell an upcoming show topic.
Awesome.
Excellent.
By the way, I received yesterday the SIO to SD interface. I had a chance to even open that box and start playing with that. So it's killing me. It's sitting next to me here on my desk. I also purchased an SIO to PC cable from a gentleman at VCF MW, and I'll be talking about my experiences with that perhaps in a later show. We'll be talking about the Atari Max version of the SIO to PC later in this show. Also, one last thing. In the last show, I mentioned that I had just purchased a bunch of vintage Atari 8-bit computer equipment on Craigslist. As you recall, it included an Atari 800, a 130XE, three 1050 drives, and a couple printers. And I was able to get everything cleaned and tested and was reasonably pleased with the results of that. I found that both computers worked and two of the three 1050s worked. The third 1050, it turns out, turned on, but when I tried to read anything, I just got errors. However, I was able to find good homes for all the 1050s on eBay, and the 130XC works perfectly, and since I didn't have one in my collection, I'm going to keep it. Unfortunately, the 800 has a missing key, so I've worked it out with another gentleman on one of the other vintage computing email groups to go in together and purchase a replacement key from Best Electronics because they have a minimum order. And so hopefully I'll be able to get that 800 100% working again. As far as the printers go, they turn on, but the 1027 needs a new head, and it's just impossible to purchase new heads for them anymore. I don't know if you guys have run into that situation or not, but it's everything I read, it's pretty difficult to get a new head for them because they just deteriorate over time.
No, I don't mess with printers. I don't know. Trying to make old printers work is not interesting to me. So,
yeah. Well, they were in the bundle, so I thought I'd try to get them working. And I believe it's the same situation with the 1025, although I couldn't really test it because, believe it or not, I don't have a parallel interface adapter for my Ataris yet. So I stored the printers away, and I don't know, maybe in a future show we could talk about some tips on restoring Atari equipment that you might come across.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'll have to dig through my boxes, but actually I may have a spare ape face or something like that I can loan you.
Well, that'd be great. I might take you up on that, Brad. Brad, what have you been up to?
Well, what do you think? How does this newfangled microphone sound?
Sounds great to me.
Yep.
Yeah. I've replaced my headset with a Blue Yeti microphone and a custom pop filter. So I hope it sounds better. And recently, the Atlanta Historical Computing Society, our club here in town, we displayed at the Atlanta Mini Maker Fair last weekend.
Awesome.
And actually had a good turnout. One of the guys, Kyle Owen, brought his PDP-8. And Brian Stewart had a Enigma kit he had built. The Enigma is the German coding machine from World War II. Mm-hmm. And they would actually code and encode codes. But and I had a Atari 400 there for the kids to play with, which obviously stopped kids to play with it. And we got a lot of parents going, oh, I had one of those when I was a kid.
What'd they play?
And they would stop and talk. And Star Raiders, Donkey Kong, a little bit of Centipede, but mostly Star Raiders and Donkey Kong were the two popular ones.
Can't go wrong with those.
Nope. And I got to remember next year to take two-player games. Yesterday, a few of us from our club attended a local ham fest, and unfortunately I didn't show anything because it was more of a sales table, but we just sit there and talk to guys and hopefully get a few more members for our club. Then as far as Atari acquisitions go, you know, as hard as I try to get more Atari stuff, all I seem to end up with is TI-99.
That's the wrong direction. You're going to have to start your own TI podcast or something to talk about it.
Tell me about it. It's almost frustrating, but you know, I wonder if nobody else will take it. Anyway.
I would offer to take some of it, Brad, but I've got equipment the way it is.
Yeah. And I'd actually given some to a guy in the club who had started a little TI-99 collection, and he gave most of it back the other day. It's like, wait a minute, it's not supposed to work this way. So what you been up to, Kevin?
I went to the Portland Retro Gaming Expo, which was just down the street from me here in Portland, Oregon. That was held October 5th and 6th. It's a two-day event. I got to go on both days. And let's see, I shopped. There were just massive tables of people selling old video games and computer things. And I played video games. There was an arcade. Everything was free. And I got to play a bunch of Lunar Lander and Tron and some of my favorite games. And I discovered a new game, or new-to-me game, called Nibbler. turns out this game is from 1982, and I really enjoyed playing that. It's kind of always fun to find an arcade game that's new to you. I handed out some stickers to promote this podcast, and had a good time. Bought a couple things. I found Super Skateboardin' for the Atari 7800. I didn't have that in my collection. And I also collect Intellivision cartridges, and I found River Raid for the Intellivision, which has proven kind of hard to find, so finally added that to the collection. So Atari Age had a booth, and it was a beautiful booth, and they were selling a lot of homebrews and a lot of software for the 2600, 7800. And they had there the Atari 7800 expansion module. Now, I'm going to first say that the Atari 7800 had a 6502 chip in it, and even though it's a game system, not a computer, I think it's fair to talk about for a minute here. So the Atari 7800 expansion module...
We'll let you get by with it this time,
Kevin. Okay, good. Thank you. it's this plug-in device that plugs into the top of the Atari 7800, and you can plug cartridges into that. And it adds features to the 7800, including a high score save, better sound, 128K of memory that's accessible by the games, and some other features. And so I was excited by this. I'm just like, hey, this neat gadget, and you know, I want to buy one. And then I was like, I recall something about this, read it about it online or something. So I checked through my old emails. I first heard about this gadget in an email from Kurt Vendel in 2009. Then I pre-ordered this thing in September 2010 for $90. And finally, 2013, I finally got to see it at the Portland Retro Gaming Expo. It's been a lot of work for Kurt and his band of nerds who have been working on this. It was exciting to finally see it. The Atari Age people said they're supposed to be out by December. I played a few games on it. Donkey Kong XM, Froggy, which was basically a version of Frogger, and something called Bentley Bears Crystal Quest. And I took some of those games and I played them on a regular 7800, and then also a 7800 that had the expansion module. And the thing that you just jumped out right away is the sound. The sound is so much better with the expansion module. Because the original 7800 basically had the same sound as the 2600, just not great. Not great sound. And then the expansion module adds Pokey and all sorts of advanced synthesis. So the game sounded great, and there's high scores saved and that sort of thing. So on Atari Age, there's a couple of forum topics about this, and Kurt recently wrote, and he said someone had asked about ordering. He's not actually taking orders on this until the expansion module shipped to all the people who pre-ordered them years ago, like me. So he said their orders were like an Atari Age version of Kickstarter. It funded the tooling of the plastics and the productions of the plastic cases and of the aluminum nameplates and the boxes and the manuals. The thing is beautiful, and it looks like it came from Atari back in the day. The fit and finish of the box and the module itself looks just like something that Atari would have released. So it looks like it'll be out sometime, maybe by the end of the year, and I'm looking forward to that.
That sounds really cool. You know, that's one of the areas I've thought of expanding into a little bit is getting a 5200 and a 7800. I've been looking at flea markets to, try to see if I can get one or the local Goodwill. But I definitely want to get one of these.
Yeah, I'd like to get one too.
And now it's time for recent news, the portion of our podcast where we talk about recent Atari news. Hard to believe there is any. It's 2013 and we've got Atari news. Take it away, Brad.
There was a little bit of internet misinformation recently. There was a report that Ted Dabney had died, and it actually was Doug, his brother. Doug Dabney had recently died. He was Atari employee number 3.
Now, Ted was one of the co-founders of Atari, right?
Yes, that is correct.
And Doug was his brother. He's the one who passed away. All right. That's too bad. Misinformation on the internet, who would have thought?
Hey, if it's on the internet, it's true, right?
It must be true. Well, also true is the ABBUC software contest ended. That's the Atari Bitbiter User Club in Germany. They had a contest for new Atari software, and there were 14 prizes given, which makes me think there might have been 14 entries, but hey, that's 14 Atari programs that didn't exist before, and I like that. And number one place was a game entitled X8, which I have played a little bit. Have you guys played it yet?
No, I haven't had a chance to.
Not yet.
It's worth trying. It's
driving me nuts.
I understand. Sorry. It's worth trying. It's a side shooter game, spaceships and shooting at bad stuff. Kind of reminded me of something in the vein of Protector. Really pretty, great music. That was X8 was the winner. Number two was something called Assembloids, which I haven't tried yet.
And Kevin, I did take a look at this. There is a YouTube video of this particular game. Mm-hmm. I have not installed the game yet, but it looks very interesting.
Awesome. Number three is Rolltris, which I did try for a minute. It's in the vein of Tetris, but the Tetris pieces fall. You don't control them, but instead you can control the mess of junk at the bottom that the pieces fall into. So you try to move the stuff at the bottom of the Tetris board to fit the falling pieces. I'm not a Tetris guy, but it seemed like an interesting variation on Tetris. Number four, something called Xerius Defect. Sounds like a game. Something called Death Chase XE, helicopter game called Heli in the Caves. The ninth prize is actually a package of 10-line programs. It's called Basic 10-Liners, and it's 6 different 10-line programs that were programmed at the NOMAM 2013 conference in Germany. The NOMAM is the not only magnificent Atari machines conference in Germany. So, a lot of new Atari games to try. There will be a link in the show notes so you can download them all to your emulator or to your real Atari and give them all a try.
I wanted to mention something else. They normally have a hardware contest as well, which usually produces some really nice hardware. But unfortunately, they only had one submission this year, so they ended up suspending the contest.
I think I'm going to try X8 tomorrow at lunch during with an emulator.
No, you should take your real Atari into work.
There you go. I like that idea.
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that. I think there's going to be some, this Friday, I think I'm going to clean up some room on my desk, and I think that will happen.
I can imagine you're going to have a bunch of geeks crowded around around your desk playing X8. That's my vision of it. I don't want to hear any different.
Okay.
Let's see. Next, I saw an interesting article at IGN.com called The Real Cost of Gaming, Inflation, Time, and Purchasing Power. And basically, it was just about how game consoles, how the prices, the relative prices have changed over the years because as the dollar loses value. And basically, I wanted to highlight one sentence of this article. It says, "The honor of the most expensive home gaming console goes to the Atari 2600. Launched in September of 1977, the Atari 2600 cost $199.99. When taking into account the 259% inflation rate between 1977 and today, the Atari 2600 cost the equivalent of $771 in today's money."
That's amazing. They sold all the millions of them when you consider what it costs in today's dollars.
Absolutely.
That's a lot of money.
But there was nothing like it. There was nothing
That's
like
true.
It. And if the kid had to have it, or frankly, anybody else in the family, you know, what are you going to do?
We didn't have one until they were probably $99.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they came down and down in price over time, of course.
Yeah, they did. Okay, this next item has to do with a computer display in London. Are you over 30? Well, it's probably no surprise to you that Tetris, Pac-Man, and the Atari computer are now classified as digital archaeology. I think we all knew that.
Archaeology is a strong word, isn't it? It's like fossils.
Yeah.
No, it's Indiana Jones.
Oh, okay. All right, I can live with that.
So there was a show in July in London called the Digital Revolution, and part of that was a digital archaeology display looking at the impact of digital technology over the last 40 years. And they had things like the ZX Spectrum and an Atari computer as well as some games like Tetris, Space Invaders, Pong, and Pac-Man. So everything they had was in working condition and were available to play. And sounds like it was a pretty nice exhibit.
Awesome. And I'll file this under exhibits that make me feel old.
On Kickstarter, there is a new documentary being, well, that actually was funded. It's called World 1-1. It's a documentary about the early days of video gaming, including all the personalities and pioneers. It says it focuses on the business deals and the creations of the engineers. And it'll be a combination of interviews, archival footage, and stuff.
I was watching this Kickstarter, and it looked like it wasn't going to fund. I mean, it was thousands and thousands of dollars away from their goal. And then at the last minute, someone must have made a big contribution because they eked out the $15,000 goal.
These Kickstarter documentaries are actually seem to be proving popular lately. There's been several of them show up, and many people seem to like them. Yeah, it looks like this one found a benefactor.
Okay, this next item is a follow-up to something that we talked about last month about JS Mesh, the JavaScript port of the multi-emulator super system. We reported it in episode 4. So the Internet Archive has now, as a follow-up to that, has announced its historical software archive, which its mission is to make older programs and games which were originally released for platforms such as our beloved 8-bit Atari available right through your browser. They've got a fairly large list at this time of software that's available, and it's expected to grow over time. So there are games like Castle Wolfenstein, Chucky Egg, Megabug, and the Atari Dealer Demo that are available through this archive. So you should check it out.
The Altera Atari emulator has been updated to version 2.4, and it looks to be lots of bug fixes, some optimized coding, and added some things like WAV audio file recording and such. So check it out. There'll be a link in the show notes.
As emulators go, is that a good one?
Yes. For Windows, I think the Altera emulator is probably my favorite one. I think Altera is the best Atari emulator out for Windows right now.
Okay.
You know, we're lucky. There are a lot of Atari emulators available for various platforms. So, you know, if you want to get your Atari fix, there are a lot of ways to do it.
Yeah, and they kind of got dried up for a while that no one was updating them. There was no work being done on them. I was looking around today, and there's three or four that actually seem to be in active development right now.
I'm sure we'll talk about emulators more in a future episode as part of the feature, but just to cover our bases, I'm a Mac guy, and I use one called Atari 800 Mac X, and there might be 15 other emulators as well, but this is the one that I tried, and it works great, so it's the one I use.
Yeah, it's the one I use for my Mac also.
All right, and I like to watch archive.org and find out what's new Atari-ish over there and report it here. There's some new Atari book scans at archive.org/details/Atari books. If you're interested in Atari Program Exchange, they added the summer 1981 and fall 1983 APX catalogs. And something I think is particularly interesting, the Atari Program Exchange Program Submission Materials document, which was basically the manual that Atari sent you if you wanted to submit your own program to APX. That's pretty fun to read. Manuals galore, the APX Pascal Language System Manual, and the manuals for Ultimon and Omnimon and TinyC and SpartaDOS and Ramrod XL and OSS Basic A+. And some books, Advanced Atari Protection Techniques, which is a guide to adding copy protection to your Atari programs, which I don't recommend you do, and a book called Electronic Computer Projects for Commodore and Atari, which has all sorts of things you can build and do. Also, while I was looking around at archive.org, I found a set of files called Atari Jazz, with a question mark, described as a 1987 cassette of Atari 800 generative music. And there's really no data about where this came from, if it was someone's personal project or something that was available commercially. But it's interesting if you're into Atari-generated chiptune music. Well, music might be a stretch. Some of it's okay, and some of it's pretty bad. You can hear it at archive.org/details/AtariJazz. It's kind of horrible. You guys want to hear some of it?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, yeah.
That wasn't too convincing.
Also music related, and a hat tip to atariteca.blogspot.com for this one. The Czech composer Adam J. Sporka created on SoundCloud a channel called Ready Atari 800 XL with original music written for Atari 8-bit computers. He says, quote, "The set contains original music and two covers I have been writing since 2010 for the 800 XL platform using Raster Music Tracker. Some of these tracks have been recorded off the authentic vintage hardware, but mostly I'm using an emulator and apply some minimal sound processing. I'm planning to release an album in early 2014. And there is a link to that in the show notes at ataripodcast.com.
You know, it's great to hear about the music capabilities of the Ataris, because you hear about the Commodore and its SID chip and all the capabilities that it had, but the Atari had some nice capabilities as well. So it's nice to know that people are doing some things with that.
Absolutely. I think Pokey could kick Sid's butt any day.
We should have a contest.
Yeah.
At least give it a rent for its money.
That's right. Okay, tips. What do you have, Randy?
First one, since we are talking about hardware that will allow you to load disk images into your Atari, I thought I might mention Atari Mania, which is a great source of Atari ATR disk images. It has a lot of information about Atari machines and has Atari magazines and various other information as well, so you should check it out.
Sweet. Brad, you got a tip?
Yeah, actually, going along with that, at archive.org, you can find the Tosec collection. And there's like 13,000 images of cartridges and cassettes and such for the Atari 8-bit line. And you can find that at archive.org. And there's a link in the show notes.
You said 13,000 images?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I went out there. I went out there yesterday, and there are a lot of images.
Yeah. They're trying to collect every Atari piece of software known to man. That's the goal.
Okay, so this next one is probably one I don't even need to mention. I imagine every Atari listener out there is going to say, Randy, we already know about this.
All right, moving on.
Sorry. Best Electronics is probably the best place to get Atari parts and supplies. And the reason I even mentioned this is because I had some recent experience where I needed to get a new key for the Atari 800 that I had just acquired, and a new key for the keyboard. And I've been working with Best Electronics to get that. So they're getting ready in February to have their 30th year in the Atari business, which is pretty amazing.
Incredible.
Cool.
All right, so I have one more tip, but I need to break our cardinal rule and about only talking about Atari 8-bit things, and I want to get your guys' clearance to do that.
I suppose this one time. What do you think, Brad?
Well, okay.
All right. So I found a new Apple podcast, an Apple II podcast, and it's called Apple Time Warp, with John Romero, and he was a co-founder of id Software and was a designer of Castle Wolfenstein 3D and Doom and Quake, and a guy named Craig Johnson, who honestly I don't know what his credentials are, but I'm sure you know he's interesting. And they talk about the early days of games on the Apple II, and they are going to be interviewing Apple II game programmers and generally cover things related to Apple II games in history. They've only done one episode, so I'm hesitant to oversell it here, but I listened to the first episode, and I really enjoyed it.
I'm going to check that out.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check it out, because yeah, John Romero is the only reason I'll let you talk about it anyway.
Well, thanks for the pass. Okay, it's time for listener feedback, where we tell you what people said to us about us or something. We have received 21 ratings on iTunes so far. Thanks everyone for the great comments and for taking the time to rate us on iTunes. We got some email. Tell me.
Well, Mike Whalen emailed us and he says, "Keep going. Just a quick thank you. This latest episode was amazing. You guys seem to be hitting a good stride right about now. Love the behind the scene interviews. I'm a big fan. Please keep going."
Awesome. Android8675 said, and I think this was on the Atari Age forums, said, "Okay, it's been four episodes. What's that opening song from? I had a copy of it back in the late 80s. I played it often on my 800. I want another copy of it, but I don't see a mention of it anywhere. Epic fail." So I told him that the music that we play at the top of the show is the Atari 800 in-store demo. The song, by the way, it's called Disco Dirge, and I want to interview the guy who programmed the demo in a future podcast. I need to line that up. I talked to him once. He was super interesting. So Android responded, "Good God, facepalm. I could not place the tune, but I remember listening to it intently. Thanks, and keep it up."
West of House replied, "Am I the only one who ran that demo many times at home, even after having owned my 800 for months? I was always so fascinated by it."
Mark from Michigan was kind enough to email us. He said, "I have also have lots of fond memories of the Atari 800. In college, we would play Mule until the wee hours, and we created a competitive baseball league using Micro League Baseball, long before fantasy baseball was ever introduced. I enjoyed tinkering with basic programming and think my Atari 800 had a lot of influence in directing me into an information technology career back in the late 80s. Thanks for providing interviews with key individuals who brought us the Atari 8-bit world. They are terrific and keep them coming. I would like to also to suggest more details about the best ways of accessing Atari software through modern means."
Hey, we're talking about that today.
Exactly.
Back at the Atari Age forums, Wood JL takes us to task for inaccuracies in the tech specs in the first episode. "I just listened to the first podcast in my car on a commute. I love it. However, there are a few inaccuracies, at least in the first one where someone says the 400 was released with 4K and the 800 with 8K. I do not believe that to be the case. I believe they were slated to be released that way, but were both actually released with a minimum of 8K. I was gifted an 8K CTIA 400 in 1980. Shortly thereafter, someone says they were both expandable to however high one wanted to go or something to that effect, which, in fact, the 400 was crippled to 16K officially until the end of its life, when Atari finally released a 48K upgrade, matching those efforts that the third-party vendors had met years before. You can still get this upgrade from Best Electronics, but you couldn't get it back when we were still fiddling with our 400 and 410 combo, back when they were fab. In one of the earlier first or second podcasts, someone said they were surprised that another person attributed power without the price to the Atari 8-bit line. That was an ST slogan. Yeah, that was me. I said that. However, the first place I remember seeing it was on the 130XE box myself." Well, we're just wrong all the time, guys.
And actually, I have a 130XE box right in front of me, and it does say that on there.
Wow. Okay. Well,
just realized that.
I like the part where we say the memory in the 800 could go however high one wanted to go. It's just like, I want 16 gigabytes.
Right.
That's what we do. I'm putting 32 petabytes in my Atari.
Anyway. Okay. John H. in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania emailed, Hey guys, I just wanted to send a letter of appreciation for you guys creating these Antic podcasts. I really loved the interview with Chris Crawford. Hearing about the how and the why of certain games and how they were made was great. Earlier this year, I finally decided to move the boxed Atari equipment up from my basement. Although I used both the ST and the Atari 8-bit, I have stronger memories and feelings about the 8-bit. First game was Monitor 2049er, first modem usage, first BBS I ran with my dad, etc. So I've been getting back into these computers and came across this podcast on Atari Age, I believe. In any case, please keep up the great work. This is a great podcast. Oh, and the little things like bringing an Atari onto a submarine, that's just great nostalgia to think about. Please keep it up.
Awesome. John Heritage emailed, I did have one suggestion to share. I know this is the Antic podcast, so what I'm about to say is complete blasphemy to you guys, but Pokey is actually my favorite chip in the Atari, so I think Pokey needs more of a fair shake. Besides being a flexible sound chip that was pretty advanced for the late 70s, i.e. two channels in 16-bit mode as an option, Pokey also handled the Atari SIO stuff. SIO, serial input-output, is really a true precursor to USB, with power provided over the cable for devices. The abilities for devices to self-manage via driver loading a power-up, device chaining, support for multiple transfer speeds, and of course, big variation in devices supported. I always thought it was a big step back that the ST never had anything like SIO, and that feature, in my mind, made the 8-bit more advanced than its competitors. He was saying, extolling the virtues of Pokey. Someone else suggested, I don't have the email here, but someone else suggested, asked why we didn't name the podcast Pokey because it's audio. And I thought that was a great idea, but he wasn't there to suggest it.
That's right. We didn't think of it at the time, did we?
Too late now. He can start his own podcast and he can call it whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And now I would like to reminisce with a commercial taking me back to the days where I couldn't afford all the Atari stuff that I wanted.
Why, get the why. This is a perfect example of how Atari home computers are making learning fun. Stacy's learning touch typing by playing Typo Attack. She's protecting her letters from these mean little typos by pressing the right keys at the right time. Get the I. Just by playing this game, she could become a real typist.
Want to try?
I thought she'd never ask.
Get the R, G, R, R, hit it.
Where is it?
And now our feature topic, all about the Atari Max SIO to PC.
I want to start out by saying that my original intention was to do a review of the various SIO to PC options that are out there. That is the ability to hook your Atari up to a PC and use it as a basically as a disk drive. Once I realized how many different options there were out there, I decided to focus specifically on just the Atari Max SIO to PC because that's something I already have, something I have some experience with, and I was able to really do a full review of this. About 2 years ago, I ordered the Atari Max Universal SIO to PC interface, and I originally had ordered the serial version. However, after I played around with it for a while, I eventually regretted that decision. I was trying to connect a newer PC that only had USB ports on it and ended up purchasing a couple of serial to USB converters before finding one that would work. During that entire process, Stephen Tucker, the person who runs the Atari Max site, answered several of my emails, helped me through it, and helped me find a converter that would work. However, even after I got it to work, I realized that going forward, I was probably only likely to ever use it on newer machines that didn't have a serial port. So I contacted Stephen Tucker again, and magnanimously, he was willing to trade my serial version of the SIO to PC with a USB version for just the difference in cost between the two devices, which was about $25, as long as I shipped him the serial version. That was more than fair, and I was extremely happy with the support I received from Steven during this entire process. So what exactly is the Atari Max SIO to PC? It's a hardware device that plugs between the SIO port of any 8-bit Atari and the USB or RS-232 port of the PC, depending on which version you have. Atari peripherals are daisy-chained from the computer, so if there's anything else on the chain, like a disk drive or a printer, the SIO to PC device would need to be the last item on the daisy chain. More recently, Atari Max has made available a version of both the USB and RS-232 models that has two SIO connectors so that it can fit anywhere in the daisy chain. If that had been available when I purchased mine, I might have gone with that model just for the flexibility, and it's only $10 more. The single SIO port RS-232 version is $35, and the single SIO port USB version is $60 plus shipping. The device comes with a shareware program called APE, which stands for Atari Peripheral Emulator, that will run on pretty much any version of Windows. I'm not sure about Windows 8, and there's a DOS version as well. There's also another program included called ProSystem. The SIO to PC and the APE ProSystem software allow you to do quite a few things. Namely, you can use your PC, like one or more Atari disk drives, using Atari disk images. You can copy disk images onto real Atari disks and make images from real disks, assuming you have a disk drive. You can transfer files to and from real disk and disk images. It allows the use of cassette images. It will accept printer output to a file or direct printing from the PC. And it can emulate a modem. My version of APE was a trial one, which means that some features were disabled. It costs $49 to purchase the license for the full-blown version of APE, but the APE registration does include a CD with 600 megabytes of ATR disk images. Here's a setup that I used when I did my testing. I had a 130XE attached to an old color TV. I had an 810 disk drive. By the way, in one of the earlier episodes of Antic, I mentioned that I had just purchased an 810 disk drive, and this finally gave me the opportunity to actually pull the cover off of that and try it out. I also, in my setup, I had a Windows XP laptop, and I had a second laptop which had 64-bit Windows 7 installed. I had the SIO to PC USB version, and then I had some cables. One SIO cable connecting the 810 to the 130XE, another SIO cable connecting the SIO to PC to the 810, and then there's a USB cable that's included that connects the SIO to PC to the Windows laptop that's running a ProSystem. Now sit back and think about that for just a second. I had the newest computer in the Atari 8-bit line, but it's still nearly 30 years old, connected to the oldest disk drive in the Atari line, connected to a six-year-old Windows laptop running XP, or to a four-year-old Windows laptop running Windows 7, and connected to the newest item in the chain, the SIO to PC. Sounds like a Frankenstein's monster, but it works very, very well. How do you install it? Well, the APE setup on my Windows machine, which is where it runs, was very easy with one caveat. I put in the CD that I got from Atari Max, and I ran the installation program for APE ProSystem. Then I plugged in the USB cable from the SIO to PC, and it installed the drivers automatically. So on the Windows XP machine, there was no issue, and I was pretty much ready to roll at that point. On the 64-bit Windows 7 machine, however, the installation failed, and I discovered that it was due to the fact that it needed 64-bit drivers, and the CD that I got from Atari Max, which admittedly was a year or two old, didn't have those drivers on it. I went to the Atari Max forum and found the 64-bit drivers once I registered, installed those per the instructions on the forum, and I had no further issues using that machine as a virtual disk drive. Now, how do you use it? Well, my main focus during this testing was file and disk image transfer. I didn't test some of the features in AAPE, such as the modem emulation feature or the cassette loading feature. And there are some features of a Pro system that won't work unless you have the registered copy. The way it works is that the PC looks exactly like a disk drive to the Atari, due to the magic of SIO to PC and the 8 Pro system software. Let me step back for just a second and talk about the disk image formats. ATR is Nick Kennedy's SIO to PC Atari disk image format. It really is the de facto standard for disk images. It's used by AAPE, SIO to PC, and all Atari emulators. When you convert your real disk to images, you should always try to use ATR images because, as I said, they're supported by nearly every emulator. Now, there's a second format called Pro, PRO, that's a proprietary disk image format used by AAPE in the Pro system. And that is used specifically for copy-protected Atari disks. But if you use that format, it's only going to be usable with AAPE and Pro System. Now, as far as using the software goes, Pro System is the first piece of software that I fired up. It's used to create ATR or Pro images from real disk, or to write ATR images to real disks. It also has features for formatting one or more disks, interrogating the drives to tell you information such as the drive model, its speed, seek timing, and other information that would help if the drive needs adjusted. And apparently, although I didn't really try this, it can make adjustments for 1050 drives. I don't know if that's a function that requires a registration or not. I did connect the SIO to PC to the 810 and to the PC. No Atari computer involved for this piece of it. You may have to configure it to tell which COM port you're using on the PC if you have the RS-232 version, or you set it to disabled if you're using the USB version. I told Pro System to scan the bus, and it saw the 810 connected as drive number one. Everything worked very smoothly. I managed to image my copy of DOS 2.5, for instance, and a couple of games, non-protected games, from real disk to ATR images. It has a pretty nice interface, as it does its sector-by-sector copy, and gives you a graphical representation as it's doing it. So, after I did that, I turned around and booted the Atari from those virtual disks using AAPE, and everything worked perfectly. Next, let's talk about AAPE. With the trial version of AAPE, there is an intentional startup delay to encourage you to buy the license. Regarding file and disk image load, the experience was very positive with APE. I completely disconnected the 810 drive at this point and went entirely off the SIO to PC, the Atari, and the PC. I loaded up some ATR images that I had saved some time ago onto some various virtual drives in APE. You can have up to 8 of them, and unloaded them into the Atari with no issue. I put a virtual disk into drive 1 that had DOS 2.5 and booted from it perfectly, and I must say it seemed much faster. I believe I read somewhere that disk loading is about 3 times faster via SIO to PC than directly from a real floppy drive. APE also has the ability to create what's called a mirror, which basically allows you to load or save individual files from or to a virtual drive without first loading an ATR disk image. It maps the virtual drive to a hard drive location on your PC, and the Atari simply thinks it's a large disk, so you can use your DOS software then to do a directory on it and do anything you would do with any standard Atari disk. There's even a utility provided called Remote that will allow you to issue remote commands from the Atari to find and load files without interacting with the Windows PC at all if you want to. I didn't spend much time with that, and I wasn't able to get it to work in that a limited amount of time. But I did read about it on the Atari Age forums. Let's say you need a blank disk image. How do you do that with APE? Well, you give it a file name, select an image size, and APE will do the rest. And then, of course, in order to use your blank disk image, you need to format it with your favorite DOS. You can load your blank image into any drive slot, then just use regular DOS format command on that image. If you're using an Atari-compatible DOS and want system files on the disk to make a bootable, to put DOS.sys and dupe.sys on them, use the write DOS files command to then add these files to the image, just as if it were a real disk. What if you wanted to create a big hard disk size image? You can create your new blank disk image as usual, except this time select custom size. You can select up to 65,535 sectors, double density. This will give you a 16 megabyte Atari hard disk image. You need to make sure you have 16 megabytes free on your PC before you create this ATR file. Note that both MyDOS and SpartaDOS will support hard disk images of any size up to the maximum size of 16 megabyte per drive. However, Atari DOS 2.0, 2.5, and 3.0 and clones will not read or write to any such image because they were designed strictly for floppy drives. How do you copy a disk image onto a real disk? This can be done using APE, but I found it actually easier just using Pro System and a real Atari disk drive. I inserted a disk into the Atari disk drive that I wanted to fill with the ATR image. Then in Pro System, I selected the write ATR images to disk drives. I got a dialog box where I could select the ATR image to write, hit start, and let it do its magic. APE comes with its own disk images for SpartaDOS and MyDOS 4.5X and their utilities. I didn't explore these, as in my testing, I pretty much stuck with DOS 2.5. Nevertheless, these are very powerful DOS versions that I know a lot of people like to use because they can be used in situations where DOS 2.5 is lacking. One other nice function in APE that I did try out was the virtual print device. You can either have printouts from the Atari routed to a printer driver on the PC. You can route the printout to a file on the PC, or you can route it to a virtual Atari 1020 plotter or Epson MX80 printer where it will be displayed on the PC in APE in a virtual printer window. So that's pretty cool. For instance, I set up the P device, which is a printer device, to go to a PDF printer driver on my PC. And when I printed to the P device on the Atari, it generated a PDF file on my PC, which I was then able to open up in a PDF viewer. It's very, very nice. Documentation. The only real negative I found is the lack of documentation for the Windows version of APE and Pro System. There are a few help files on imaging and setting up the interface, and there's an FAQ that's helpful, but there's no comprehensive manual on the website. What is there is an under construction note. The DOS version has a full manual, but that doesn't help with the Windows version. This scarcity of documentation means you have to try to figure out what's going on, mostly from just playing with things in the user interface. It's not too difficult to do this, but an overall manual that touches on each of the piece of functionality in APE and Pro System would definitely is sorely needed. Another helpful piece of information would be something that shows the differences between the registered and unregistered versions of APE. At least I didn't see that there was anything out there like that. For example, I went through the process of trying to copy a single file from a real disk to a mirrored location on the hard drive, only to end up with a zero-byte file with no explanation. And then when I did some searching on the website, I discovered that this is because that function only works with a registered version of APE. To summarize, all in all, I would say this is a great piece of hardware and software that I had a lot of fun with pulling out and playing with again. The first time you turn on the Atari and hear it boot from your PC and sound exactly as if it were booting from a real Atari drive, although a little faster, it'll blow your mind. The cost is very reasonable for the power you get, and Stephen Tucker seems to do a great job of helping you with any issues that you might run into. It's a great way to extend the life of your Atari without the hassle of dealing with temperamental disk drives and deteriorating floppy disks.
So I'm a Mac guy, and more than 3 years ago, I did use APE and an SIO to serial cable on an old PC that did have serial ports, and it worked well. But I had this PC running, I think it was Windows 95, that I didn't use for anything other than except as a peripheral for the Atari. And when I moved to Portland from California, I decided to leave it behind, just decided having this unitasker giant PC in my life was no longer necessary. But as I said, I'm a Mac guy, and I knew it would be possible to make my Mac the host for the Atari, and it totally is, using a piece of software called SIO to OS X. It's shareware, it's $25, and more or less does similar magic that APE does on the PC. It can emulate 8 disk drives, you can print to it, it just turns whatever you print into a text file on the Mac, which is super convenient, and it has Atari 850 emulation for other devices. So I like this because I can use my Mac that I already have as a peripheral for the Atari, and it's worked for me reasonably well. I've used it with an SIO to serial cable and then a serial to USB dongle attached to that. Like Randy, I did have some trouble with the serial to USB dongle. Certain chipsets just don't function well enough to do the job. I think I tried 2 or 3 dongles before I found one that worked. It worked well enough anyway. Even when I had things tuned as well as I could with the best USB dongle and the best settings in SIO to OS X, I could never get past timing problems in the serial communications. I don't know if it was a problem with the dongle or with the software, but the best way I can describe it is the disk drive goes beep, 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 and it makes a scratch like a needle on a record album. And the data gets through, but it just slows things down and it just bugs me because I know things aren't working as well as it should. Anyway, SIO to OSS works well enough, but I don't use it anymore. Instead, I tend to use an SIO to SD device, and that's a little gadget that plugs into the Atari that makes the Atari think that an SD card is its disk drive. I prefer it over SIO to PC or SIO to OS X because it doesn't require that I have a PC or a Mac within a cable's reach. I don't need to fuss with special software. I just want to, if I want to move software from the Mac to the Atari, I can just move the SD card between the two computers. I think we're going to probably talk about SIO to SD in a future episode.
We definitely will. Yep. I've not played with that particular software, Kevin, so I can't speak to it, but I'll probably give it a try one of these days and see if I have a similar experience to you.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know if you have the same timing issues that I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I guess we have a bonus feature this episode, right, Randy?
Yeah, while I was at VCF Midwest, I was able to pull Nick DeMasi, who's president of SCAT, to the side, and we were able to talk for a few minutes, and I thought I'd share it with you guys.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm here with Nick DeMasi of the SCAT group. Nick, could you talk about the group a little bit and what you guys do?
Yeah, SCAT stands for Suburban Chicago Atarians. We are a small Atari computer club. We used to be much larger back in the day. I think SCAT's been around since the 80s. It certainly already existed before I joined it. I actually used to do just online stuff back in the day when you had dial-up services like CompuServe and the Source. I was on Delphi. And I kind of thought, oh, I don't need a users group because I have people on here. And then I realized I liked the face-to-face contact. And a friend of mine joined SCAT, who was into Atari, so I did too. And ultimately, I ended up president, apparently for life at this point.
So is the group pretty active today?
We still meet. We rarely skip a month. Occasionally, if we just don't have anything for a demo and it's not convenient for anyone. The nice thing about having a small club is we can change our meeting day. In other words, we normally meet on the second Saturday of each month, but actually it moves around. Since I host most of the meetings and I'm the president, if I'm going to be gone that weekend at a convention or something, I'll say, hey guys, that weekend's bad for me. How about, you know, the third Saturday or the first or whatever? And they'll usually say just fine. Or we'll, you know, we'll agree on a time to meet. And we've thought about skipping the summer sometimes, but we normally don't. And then once a year we try to have a group barbecue. We've, over the last 3 years, we've had that twice. And we just had it, our barbecue this month. In fact, it was last weekend at the home of our treasurer, Joe Chico. And everyone who is either a member or who is on what I call my outreach email list, you may notice there's an email sign-up sheet in the room there where we have our tables. And if you put your name and email on there, we will send you email notices of the meetings. And it's not an interactive list, so you don't get any spam. It's just, it's actually just a list in my address book. Mm-hmm. So I think we're reasonably active. We had a new member join recently, and another fellow who was considering joining offered to give a demo in November. So that's actually the most activity we've had in a while.
So how many members do you currently have?
We have 7 paid-up members and a couple of guys who I haven't tossed off the roster because they were former officers and they no longer live in town, so I'm kind of keeping them on there kind of as a courtesy. One of them is our long-lost newsletter editor. We used to have a newsletter, and this fellow, last I heard anyway, lives in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, of all places, because we have members who are not local to the Chicago area. Mm-hmm. At least we had. But unfortunately, he seems to have dropped off the grid or something. So he just stopped sending me newsletters, and I tried contacting him, and unfortunately, all I had for him was an email. So, what I should do is start writing a president's letter again, which is what I did when we had no newsletter, but I really would like to have a newsletter. So, if anyone out there is interested in being a newsletter editor and would like to join the club and do that for us, we would welcome that, because that's what happened with this fellow. Otherwise, I may just have to go back to the old president's letter, which really isn't as much fun.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. What did? How did you get started with computers? And was the Atari your first machine?
Ataris were the first computers that I owned. I have an undergraduate degree in mathematical computer science from St. Louis University, which did not have a computer science program. They had this. And I have a master's in computer science from Purdue University. But I did
great
not...
school.
Thank you. But I did not actually own a computer of my own when I moved up here in 1980 from St. Louis, which is where I'm from. I went to, I think it was called the Midwest Microcomputer Show. I don't have any literature left from it or anything, but it was at McCormick Place. And I'd never been to any kind of microcomputer show, much less anything at McCormick Place, but I found it. And it was like driving all day to get across town compared to St. Louis, which is a smaller scale city. And I saw their various things like Apple IIs and whatnot, and parts for Apples. And I saw a display of what turned out to be an Atari 400, and it was playing a game that many Atari 8-bit fans know and love, Star Raiders. And I saw this, I thought, you know, I've been thinking about getting a video game machine, but I wouldn't mind a computer. And this sort of seemed like both. And in fact, I saw that it had a keyboard, and I asked the fellow behind the table or at the booth, say, is this programmable? He says, yes, there's a basic cartridge for it. And I thought, wow. So I said, where can I buy one? He said, look at, name some stores. And I went around and found a store that actually had them. It was called Computerland, and I bought one. At the time, I think it cost about $400, and there were no disk drives available yet, so I bought one of the program recorders, the tape drive, I call it. Mm-hmm. And that was my first Atari, and since then I've had an 800, an 800 XL, which I still have, and 2 130 XEs, the first of which I actually damaged attempting to remove the OS ROM chip myself so I could put in a socket and another chip, an aftermarket 80-column chip called an OmniView, and I found out the hard way that one should not take a soldering iron and a little spring-loaded desoldering tool to a board like that. And I ended up buying another one and having a TV repair place that fixes Atari said, oh, they do it for the cost of the diagnostic upfront fee, like $25 plus the socket. So the machine I still have in there has that chip in it. Plus it has another aftermarket mod, my IDE, which is a little board that, in my case, has leads, has wires that are soldered onto various pins of the CPU chip and another chip. I did not do this, by the way. Our club's software librarian, officially, is also unofficially our hardware guy. And he actually is a trained PC technician, and he knows how to desolder things. He has a vacuum desoldering tool, and he can remove a chip, put a socket in, all things like that. And so he installed this upgrade for me, and I have a compact flash card in there, and that's an internal drive. It simulates floppy, except that two of the partitions are very big. And so since I've been using the machine with that in it, it's rekindled my interest in the 8-bit and got me to use that machine a lot more and have fun with it.
So you focus mainly on the 8-bits then?
Personally, I was sort of mixed. I actually also have an Atari TT-030.
Oh, wow.
In fact, once I got that, I did not use the 8-bit as much, although my wife continued to use it. She liked the Synfile database from Synapse and used that for professional organizations she belongs to and other things for quite some time. But I was pretty enamored of my TT-030. That was my main machine until I think February 2002 I finally got a Mac. I used Mac. Mostly because I needed a machine that I could run Microsoft Word on to work on my resume because I was tired of going to someone's house or the library. But otherwise, I was using that Atari for everything that I would use a computer for at home. Now, of course, at work, wherever I worked, they had computers and I'd use those. But I had a Flash 2 terminal emulator on there, and that was back in the dial-up days. I could dial up boards and whatever with that machine and use it online. I had a browser on there. I could browse the web as long as you didn't mind it being a little bit slow. And, of course, as web pages got more and more graphic-intensive, it became harder and harder to tolerate with that machine. But it's still, if I could hook it up to the Internet now, which is possible with the right attachments or something, I could probably still use it for some websites because some of them are not all that bad.
So what did you bring to the show this year?
What I brought to the show was the modified 130XE that I mentioned previously, along with a couple of monitors so that I can literally monitor what's happening from behind the table if someone's playing a game or whatnot on it. We have a little 8-bit breakout box, which is actually shaped like a black cylinder, and I can't remember where we bought that from, but I could find out. But in any case, it has it plugs into the video out port, the monitor out port of the 8-bit, and it breaks out the audio NTSC, you know, plain ordinary video, and the S video or split chromoluma, although it's an actual S video connection. So I have the S video hooked up to our club's monitor, which is literally a miracle monitor. That's the brand name of the monitor. And I like to say it is a miracle monitor because it survived the flood that we had in our basement in 4 feet of water and still works. And then the regular video, NTSC video, is connected to a little monitor that I call our roadshow monitor that was actually being given away by a school, and our former vice president snagged it. It just displays ordinary NTSC video, and that's it. So that's what I brought. And then Rory, our librarian and webmaster as well, actually, brought a 1040 STE, I believe, and also a PC laptop on which you can run Atari emulation for 8-bit, and I think ST, although I think he's mostly running the 8-bit emulator today.
Okay. Are you planning to continue to come to these shows?
Definitely. We have a good time here, and as I said, we've gotten people signed up on our email list here. People take flyers, and occasionally we'll get contacted by people who are interested in the club. So
sometimes you'll pick up membership.
Yeah, sometimes I'll pick up. No one has actually joined here, although people are certainly welcome to. I have the membership cards, and the back of our flyer has an application form, and people can join here. But we have gotten people signed up on our email list here, and some of them end up joining from time to time. Like I said, our email list has no spam attached to it. It's not a interactive list on any of the interactive services. It's just a list in my address book, so nothing goes to the list unless I send it. And the disadvantage of that is that it's on my computer only, but the advantage is that no one can ever get any spam, as I said, because I'm on other lists where spam finds its way into there. But yeah, and also it's just a good time. I mean, it kind of gets me away from doing other things and doing stuff with the Ataris. So
yeah, there's a pretty impressive Atari display here today, I have to say, a good Atari presence. So have you come to all of these shows? This is 8.0.
This is 8.0. The first one that I recall going to was VCF Midwest 4.0, and that was at Purdue University. And we actually did have tables there. Prior to that, there was a show called the Video Game Summit that we used to go to, but I mean, it's local for us now. We don't even have to travel to go to it, so it worked out pretty well, and we hope it keeps going for some time. Like I said, we enjoy it.
Well, good luck to your group. Hopefully it'll continue to stay in existence and you continue to find people that are interested. It's harder and harder these days as the machines get older and people get older. But I wish you luck and thank you for the interview. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Randy, for interviewing me. I appreciate it, too.
Well, thanks for the interview, Randy. Super interesting. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to our show. We certainly welcome your feedback. Please take a minute and rate this show on iTunes. That's really the best way you can help us become the formidable podcasting juggernaut that we aspire to be. We really want to own the Atari 8-bit podcasting space. And the way we can do that, frankly, is if you go to iTunes and give us 5 stars. And also tell all of your retro computing nerdy friends about Antic, because you know you have them. If you have memories of the Atari 8-bits that you want to share, or you're working on a project involving an Atari 800 computer, we want to hear about it. You can contact us in a variety of ways.
You can get a hold of us via voicemail at 206-426-7200.
Or you can contact us via email at antic@ataripodcast.com.
Or on Twitter at Atari Podcast. Our website with show notes, every link that we mention in this show will be there at ataripodcast.com. See you later. Thanks for listening.
Bye, everyone.
Good night.
I told the 6-year-old, I'm recording something downstairs. I need you not to be running. She's like, okay, Dad, but I need to run to make the jump.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. With no further interruption. Hold on a second. What, Camellia?
Are you going to be working on this after dinner?
I'm probably going to be done soon.
Good, because I really want to try to get that jump.
Okay. I'll finish as fast as I can.
Daddy,
you have to go. I will talk to you. I will talk to you when I'm done in maybe 15 minutes.
I totally nailed it. Now I'm trying to do it again. But yesterday, and today I can't do it. So I'm really working on it.
All right. I'll let you know as soon as you can do your job.
But Dad, I want to be part of your podcast.
Yeah. Dad, I've almost got that jump figured out.
I'll be totally quiet, I promise.